Coast Guard. What do they actually do here in New Zealand? I had no idea. I mean, I've seen the old movies with this helicopter and then they jump out of the helicopter and the boat's like sinking, it's on fire and there's like bodies jumping out and, you know, you've got to pick one. Is it the baby or is it the mum or is it the dude? Who are you picking? I was always curious how that actually works. So we talked to someone that works intimately with the Coast Guard. So if you've ever been curious about how the Coast Guard actually works, as well as other things, then have a look. How do you even become a Coast Guard? Like what? You're in that world. What do you?
That all came about 12, 13 years ago when I bought a small fish boat and went down to the boat ramp and there was a Coast Guard boat check guy saying, you know, would you like us to go run through your boat to make sure it's seaworthy and you've got all your gear and stuff like that? And I went, yeah, sure. And the final thing was he looked at the anchor and said, yeah, the anchor looks great. Is the warp actually attached to the boat? And I said, well, of course it is, thinking, actually, I don't know that. So we pulled all the line out. We're talking, you know, 30 metres of line came out. And sure enough, it wasn't. And I said, well, thanks for that, because actually I really didn't know. And it's very rare you need to put that amount of line out anyway, but it should be attached to the boat. And then we got talking, and I said, so how do I join as a volunteer? So that's 12 years ago. So the way it works is we're on call if it's an urgent, so that's a mayday or somebody's in, you know, serious trouble. We have an app on our phones that goes off. And if I can go, I will go. So I will say to the team here, I'm out of here. I've got all the gear in the back of the car. And we go to the boat and we do whatever we do. So it's sort of a 24/7 on call. The reality is that doesn't happen very often. And the commitment is 1 week in three, you make yourself available for like training, non-urgent, you know, somebody's run out of fuel, batteries packed up, the motor's crapped out or whatever it might be. So it is a long-term commitment, but it's not onerous. And the bunch of people you work with are just amazing. And I think that's because you've got to have a certain sense of something, whatever it is, to actually do it in the first place. It's completely unpaid. It's a hell of a lot of fun. One of the boats we drive has got 600 horsepower on the back. So if you're a bit of a speed freak, that's probably the boat for you. And she will go very quickly, which is important. So if we get tasked to a mayday, you know, time is of the essence. We need to get there really quickly. And she'll do about 47 knots, which is extremely fast. So we're all very well trained in, you know, if you're doing that kind of speed, you have to be very careful with your surroundings, with how you handle the boat, your other crew members, et cetera, et cetera. So we're always on the water training and making sure we're the best we can be. And it's good fun. Mm.
Do they have like buds like Navy SEALs where you get hazed and you have to go through all these criteria, or do they have like the, if someone's done it for quite a while and then a new guy comes in, they put you through everything? But I guess because it's a volunteer, they just want you to turn up. Anything like that?
Pretty much. No, there's a great sense of camaraderie, you know. So new kid on the block, and I remember when I joined, you know, I just felt welcomed. And right, I had a history of boats, so I knew, you know, I knew how to drive a boat. I thought I didn't. And I knew lots of stuff. So there's a great training program, but it's actually the people around you that made the difference, whether it be a skipper or somebody who's been around a long time, helping hand. You know, we all stuff things up from time to time. You're not made to feel an idiot because you stuffed up. It's shit happens sometimes. Let's work out why it happened, what happened, and how can we prevent it happening in the future. So it's very embracing for everybody. Yeah. So a newbie coming in probably look at us old farts sometimes and thinks, oh my God, you know, but we've got to We've got a young lady. She's just turned 21. She works on the ferries. I believe she's just become the youngest skipper for the ferry companies. And she's going for a skipper's ticket on Coast Guard. And if she does, she'll be the youngest by a country mile. And she's great. She's really, you know, she's up for it. She's enthusiastic. She lives around boats. She's a ferry skipper. So, you know, her life is boats. And she just brings youth and perspective, which us old ones sometimes, you know, we tend to lose sight of that.
Just on that front, like, a lot of people have a common question around, like, a young person trying to lead people that are older than them, like skipping, you know, in a sense, you're saying, hey, we've got to try this, and it's more collaborative as well if you're a great leader. But have you ever had a moment in your career where you're younger and you're trying to lead, or what would lead, help you listen to someone that's 21? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
How would they approach you?
Yeah. I think in Coast Guard, let's stick with that. The skipper's there for a reason. So you've got the legal status of a skipper, but also you've got the respect that you've been through all the training. Being a skipper or obtaining a skipper's ticket is not easy. So whether it's male, female, whether it's someone like me, somebody much, much younger, somebody coming from the UK, somebody coming from China, somebody, it doesn't matter. The fact is they are the skipper of the boat, and you give them that respect, and that's just normal. So I certainly don't have a problem, and I don't know of anybody else on the boats that has a problem with, we've got skippers, trying to think of the age of our youngest skipper, probably mid-30s. Most Coast Guard volunteers are male, white male between, say, 40 and 65. So, you know, there might be people that might think, well, if you've got a female skipper at 35, are you actually going to be as respectful as a skipper male at 50? And the answer is yes, they're a skipper. And we all talk to each other. And because we're volunteers, if a skipper says, I want you to do this, and you feel that that might put you or your crew member or the vessel in danger, it's actually incumbent on you to say something. And nobody will cut you down for saying something, because at the end of the day, we all want to get home safely. We've all got families. And we do go out in some fairly challenging situations, and we just need to be safe.
What are some of those challenges that you've been, like, was it stormy seas? Was it like, you know, you had to do it like the movies where there's a chopper with the light and you're swimming over to the boat? Like, what?
There's lots. So one I recall, we're coming down from Cowow, which is an island just north of where we are. It was pretty snotty, so probably 2.5 meter sea. And there was a yacht coming towards us, which was obviously out of control. So we flicked our boat round the back of their boat, and the whole back of their boat was crimson, and it should have been white. And the boom was flapping around, and this is where maybe a bit of knowledge comes in, a bit of experience. We just knew what had happened. And so we pulled up alongside, and sure enough, there was a guy in the cockpit, unconscious, with a huge gash in the top of his head, and he'd been hit by the boom. So we put our people on board, patched him up, calmed him down, made sure he was stable. And at the end of the day, we're on a boat, so we're not doctors. We're just there to stabilize. So we radioed through for the ambulance service to meet us at Army Bay. There's always humor in most things. And I remember we got into Army Bay, and it's flat calm. And there were two of us jumped off the side of the boat up to maybe our chests in water. And we held the stretcher above our head to walk towards the boat ramp, and I went straight into a hole. And I probably was up to here in water. And the ambulance crew absolutely wet themselves laughing. I was trying my best not to dump our patient into the water, which we succeeded in not doing. And we got him to the shore, and we got an email maybe a week or so later from the guy just saying, awesome, you know, basically saved my life. But there was a bit of humour in there.
Yeah.
As well.
Holding your breath.
Well, yes. It was funny. We did laugh about it afterwards. Through to some, you know, really gnarly seas. I've been out in 6 meters, 7 meter seas. That's challenging. Sometimes I ask myself, why do members of the public go out in that kind of sea? But that's not really for me to actually say anything, but I do wonder it. We've had some daily stuff. You know, people are out on their boat with the family, something goes wrong. So it could be a battery goes flat. Lots of people have lots of toys on boats these days, so they park up. And the poor old engine and battery, normally from a boat ramp to where you go, is less than half an hour. So you then put the anchor down, go fishing, and you've got, you know, your fish finder, you might have a radar, you might have a radio, you might be charging your phone. You know, this all takes a strain on the battery. And then they go and start the engine or go to start the engine and it doesn't work. So we have jump packs on boards. We jump start people. And that's probably the majority of our stuff is jump starts, fuel, or breakage, mechanical failure. And then we just tow people back to, you know, whether we try and get people back to their home port if we can. But if not, we get them to the nearest safe place and set them up.
How do you, like, prepare for, like, a big storm? Let's say you're out in the seas and you just got word that you're this far away from home and a big storm's coming. One, how do you know if a storm's coming? Might be a bit simple question, but and then once these big ass waves and you're on your boat, what are you meant to do? Is there anything you can do? You just go straight? Like, what's
all right? So you're talking being on the Coast Guard boat or on your personal boat?
Let's say personal boat, because not many people are going to get much value from the Coast Guard.
No. So if you're on your own boat, then really before you leave, there should be certain checks that you do. So the basics would be life jackets, two forms of communication. So preference would be a VHF radio, either a handheld or built-in. And in the Hauraki Gulf, where most boats operate, cell coverage is actually pretty good. So a cell phone, but put it in a waterproof container. So you need, you know, make sure your boat's up to scratch, so it's fueled. Rule of thumb, if you've got a powerboat, is a third for the outward journey, a third for the inward journey, and a third in case something goes wrong. So that should be that sort of in the back of your head. Really important, well, two other important things. One is to log what's called a trip report. So that can be done from a phone app or on the radio. So it's basically telling Coast Guard, I'm leaving Gulf Harbour, I've got three people on board, and I'm going fishing off the noises. And I expect to be back at around 5 o'clock this afternoon. That's it. That's all you have to do. So over time, because you've got a call sign, that builds up a picture. So in the event that at 8 o'clock that night, your wife phones in to say, my husband hasn't come home, Coast Guard can have a look at where it's likely that you might be. So then we can send the boat out to see if you're okay. So trip report's really important. And equally important is weather. Check Met Service. Coast Guard have an app, which will give you weather forecasts, give you tides, give you wind speed. It's look at it and understand that you might go out in flat calm, but the Iraqi Gulf can change in half an hour from being quite pleasant to extremely unpleasant.
How do you find, so let's say, you know, planes gone down, like the Malaysian Airlines that they never found.
Correct, yeah.
Do you just wing it, or they say, hey, we're in this sort of location, this blue looks like this blue, this is our radar, and then they've got like a tracking beacon, or how do you even yeah. like find a person?
I think there's various things here. So we operate under we call it operations. So in Auckland there's the command center, if you like, and they've got a huge TV on screen which has got all sorts of gizmos built in for tracking. So a lot of it is if a vessel or a plane has got a transponder, they'll know pretty much where it is. So they will then radio through to us the coordinates of where it might be or where they think it might be. So we can plot that on a chart plotter and head off. And there will be multiple units. In that event, it wouldn't be just one boat. You know, they'd send out everything they could find. Coast Guard also has an aircraft, Cessna aircraft, which can obviously cover great distances and pinpoint and guide us in to where it, you know, where it might be. Other assets might be police. You know, they've got a big launch called Deodar, which is a very sinister-looking vessel. And my goodness, can she move? So that would be coordinated with the police. You've got Harbour Master. There's a whole heap of resources available to make sure we can get to people quickly and make sure they're okay.
Well, I didn't think we were going to talk about this for so long, but I don't know anything about it. But let's say, like, you're on the Titanic or whatever, you're on a boat, and now you've thrown off, and you got your life jacket. And is there any best practice? Like, you just, like, you know, you try and catch some kinna. There's no rocks there, so you can't swim deep enough to get any kinna. How do you survive? What do they teach you? What do you do?
Well, we actually had this a few years ago now. There was a cruise boat, left Auckland, late afternoon. And then they radioed through a mayday, and that was a passenger had gone overboard. They did have a life jacket on. Basically, all hell broke loose. So every available vessel, police helicopter, Westpac helicopter, our own aircraft. I mean, it was a massive undertaking. And we found him. He was in the water for about 5 hours. He was okay, dehydrated, swallowed a lot of water, but he was, you know, he was okay. And the reason we found him was, and all credit to the cruise ship crew, they always have lookouts. And it was a very quick thinking lookout, saw it happen. And obviously, therefore, we had a position. So we knew where he'd gone in the water and then goes back to operations. They've got all sorts of gizmos, which will say the drift at that time and the wind at that time and the wave pattern at that time indicate he will be drifting in a certain direction. So you time that. So you wouldn't look over here because he's gone. You would look down here because that's the likely place of where he would be. So that was a live one. That happened whenever that was. Yeah, a few years ago now.
It's crazy that you can plot out the direction of the water. Like, yeah. I mean, I honestly know nothing about this, so it's just fascinating. Like, yeah, so he just, and what was the tea? Like, why did they, were they trying to, like, jump off themselves, or you can't divulge it?
I don't know.
They tripped.
And that's one of the funny things. We've done a few, what I call interesting jobs over the years, and we never know what happens next. And sometimes I sit back and think, I'd like to know what happened to that person and stuff. But unless they send us an email or pick up the phone or whatever, we don't know. We don't know. So all it matters really is, you know, we were tasked to do something. We did what we did. Somebody went home that day or the next day or the day after that alive, where if it hadn't been for us lot, maybe they wouldn't.
Yeah, well. Hey, have you ever, like your intuition sparked up, like something just didn't add up? So you go there, and, you know, there's a husband, he's passed out, you know, maybe he was poisoned or something. You know, like, was there ever, like, you can't say that it happened, but was, like, there ever a thing you're like, this doesn't make sense, you know? The banana was left on the table, but he's allergic to bananas. Like,
yeah. No, I know what you're saying. I know what you're saying. I mean, yes. I mean, there's on the boat, we may have five or six crew on the boat, and so there'll be a huge amount of experience, depth and breadth of experience. And, you know, the old adage is it doesn't look right. It probably isn't right. So go back to the story of the yacht that was clearly not under control. There were enough of us on board that have sailed that looked at that boat and said, that ain't right. There's a problem. And we were probably a good mile away when we first saw it. But you just know. Other ones, you know, you come across a boat and you look at it and it's like, is it sitting in the water as it should do? No, it's not. Okay, so what's the problem? You know, has it got a hole in the hull? there's one person on board that you can see, but maybe there's somebody else down below that you can't see. And you know, are they okay? So there's a whole heap of stuff that goes through your head when you're coming across boats.
Was it ever menacing, or is it all just human error mostly?
There's been a couple of occasions where it's like, oh, I'm not sure about this. Are you familiar with the story of the Marie Celeste? You heard that story?
No.
Okay, so the Marie Celeste was a cargo sailing boat, maybe 100 years ago now, and she was found adrift off the coast of the UK. All the sails were set. The jug was still hot. Everything was there except the crew. And nobody this day knows what happened. So it was just sailing along, obviously not very well because it had no crew. So it's the story of the Marie Celeste, one of sea life's, you know, enduring mysteries. Well, bring it right up to date. Waiheke Island, a few years ago now, a very large squall came through and a couple of yachts dragged their anchors and were causing quite a lot of damage. And so we were tasked to one of them to go and see what we could do. So we came alongside. I jumped in the back of this boat, probably about a 40-foot yacht. And the companionway, which is the door that goes down below, was open. And I looked there, and there was a set of car keys and a cell phone and a wallet. So that said to me that there was somebody on board. So I shouted down below, you know, hello, Coast Guard here, you okay? No response. Okay. So I went down into the main cabin area, and I touched the jug, and that was still warm. And I'm looking around, and there's clothes everywhere. And I'm going, okay. So hello, you know, Coast Guard, anybody here? No, nothing. Walked through towards the front of the boat, and there were two doors both shut. So I knocked on the first one, which was the main sleeping area. Knocked on that, no response. Opened the door, nobody there. So I'm beginning to think, this is a bit creepy. Knocked on the final door, which was the heads, which is the toilet. No response. Opened it. Nobody there. So I walked back through the saloon, making sure there was nobody on board. And all the time, back of my head, I've got, there's a set of car keys, there's a mobile phone, and there's a wallet. Yeah, okay. So I picked up the phone, and fortunately it was one old style phone that wasn't locked. And in the contacts was one called ICE, which is quite common. So ICE stands for in case of emergency. So I hit ICE, and this woman answered the phone and said, oh, hi, Dave. And I said, no, it's not Dave. My name's Jeff. I'm with Coast Guard. I'm on his boat. And it broke its mooring, and we're just a bit concerned. And she said, oh, my God. This is not the first time this has happened. It is his birthday, and I happen to know that his son, who lives on Waiheke, was taking him out for lunch. So what's happened is the son's gone out to the boat on the dinghy, picked father up. They've buggered off to one of the vineyards, probably on the island. So he didn't need his wallet. He didn't need his car. Didn't need his phone. And that's what happened. We towed the boat, got it safe, put it onto the mooring. We hung around for a while, and father and son came back. Son was sober, father probably wasn't. He saw his boat, and he said, but I didn't leave it there. And I said, no, you didn't. It broke its mooring, so we had a good old laugh about that. And off we went. And so that was my Marie Celeste.
You solved it one crime at a time.
Experience, but it was just really spooky going through that boat, thinking all the signs are somebody should be here, and they weren't. You know, so anyway, that was quite fun.
Yeah, if you didn't think, like, immediately, I was like, well, if you didn't think to call that in case of emergency, I would have been like, oh, there's someone overboard. We got to search the perimeter. That's what I would have gone to.
Yeah.
But you made that call.
Yeah. And then there's everything in between. You know, we've been called out. I can tell you this one.
yeah, I see you
processing. So this would be September a while ago, and we're on patrol in the harbour, Auckland Harbour. and a member of the public shouted at us saying that there was a guy in a rowboat rowing from, or trying to row from the city towards Rangitoto. And he was rowing with a fishing rod. So it's like, okay. So we shot, I was driving, so we shot over to this guy, this little boat, and sure enough, there's this very small dinghy, half submerged, pretty rough. And the guy is in shorts and a singlet, singing his head off, and he's rowing with a fishing rod. So it's like, okay. So we grabbed hold of his boat. You're okay, mate, blah, 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 blah. And he then got his gum boots, and he was starting to get rid of the seawater with a gum boot. And then he drank some of the seawater. And most people know is you don't drink seawater. It's really bad for you. But why was he drinking seawater? And the reason he was drinking seawater was to swallow the frozen Brussels sprouts that he was trying to eat. So you can't make that up, can you? You know. So next thing I know, the police launch comes alongside, grab this guy, put him straight into a straitjacket on the back of their boat, and they bugger off. And we're left bobbing up and down in the water. And it was like, did that happen? So we went back to, we were called by the police to go to the Marine Rescue Center to do a debrief. And as we got there, this guy was being marched up the ramp to a waiting ambulance. And he was still singing his head off on there. Anyway, we later learned that he was completely off his face. On probably pay young, I don't know. So we stopped him drowning, basically.
Wow.
I just never forget the drinking seawater to swallow frozen Brussels sprouts. That was, bizarre.
Yeah, it's not people's favorite vegetable at the best of times, let alone
I love
warm
them.
From seawater.
I love them, especially when you bake them with walnuts and stuff like that. Oh, lovely. Anyway, but I wouldn't eat them frozen. And I certainly wouldn't wash it down with seawater.
Gee, what would happen? Do you go insane? Like, I understand osmosis, so if you've got too much salt in your system.
You drown.
You just drown from drinking seawater.
Yeah, you just drown. Yeah.
Can you expand on that? What happens?
The salt... The salt obviously causes dehydration, so that will push you into hypothermia. Your body begins to shut down. When your body shuts down, you lose control of your extremities, so your hands and your legs and stuff like that, because the body will protect the core. Well, of course, if you've got water splashing on your face and you can't do anything about it, you'll eventually just swallow too much water. You'll drown. Simple as that.
Wow. Okay, yeah, because your arms aren't working, so you're just getting water and then you just drown.
Yeah.
Oh my God! So maybe don't drink seawater. Is there ever a good time to drink it? Can you cook it? Like, what do you do when you're on a boat and you can't get any food or water? Like, do you wait for it to rain?
Well, I mean, they're old stories, aren't they? So you can set up if you're on a sailboat, you would set up some kind of collection system to collect the dew from your sails. If you've got a powerboat, you might set up a tarpaulin. For the same reason, to collect the dew, or you pray for rain. At the moment, Jesus. I don't think you would pray for rain because I'm amazed there's still rain up in the sky, and I'm not quite sure how much water the land can take.
Yeah,
but that's another thing. You know, when you leave your particularly most people go for day trips, is make sure you've got enough water. God. You know, take some bottled water, or keep some on board. You know, keep a 5-liter container, of water on board at all times, because you never know. And here, as we all know, in the summer it can get blisteringly hot, and if you're exposed, you will just dehydrate really quickly.
That's crazy.
And on our Coast Guard boat, we all carry our own supply of water, and then the boat's also got a supply.
So horrific. Like, you hear those people that have survived in the sea for 3 months or whatever. Like, you imagine, I get sunburn after being outside for 20 minutes, let alone just...
You and me both.
The atomic head. Does it get, yeah. Do you know much about, like, what would happen if someone's caught adrift like Castaway and, like, the progressive decline of their systems?
No. I mean, there's a lot of good stories out there and a couple, you know, some good books which have been written by people who were cut adrift or survived for months. And you just go, wow, you know, the human being is a pretty amazing creature in that they can adapt. You know, somebody said to you, or said to me, you know, would you like some kinna? No. It's like drinking salty snot.
Good summary.
It's horrible. But, you know, if I was in the situation where I'm going to live or die, hey, I'd be lapping up salty snot, you know, because it's full of good stuff to keep you alive. So we adapt.
That's so horrific because you, like, I can't even fathom the idea of being able to get a fish, a bird, and you're waiting for it to rain and all you got is a shirt. You know what I mean? Like, what are you going to... And then if you drink it, you're going to drown. Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, that's probably the biggest... That's probably the biggest one, that you've got all that water around you and what's the poem? The poem of the ancient mariner. And there's a line in that. There's, yeah, water everywhere, but not a drop to drink. Absolutely right. And that was written 300 years ago.
Jesus, that what it's about. I thought it was about. Yeah, wow.
Yeah.
Okay, well, this went on a 31-minute journey.
And we didn't talk about mortgages and stuff. So there are a lot of stories, as there is with everything. But in our world, we really, really like taking people from the no space and then converting that to the yes space. That gives us here a real kick. You know, it's you know, we did it. We got them over the line. It's great.
So what about negotiation tactics then, in a sense? Have you ever heard of the book Never Split the Difference from an FBI hostage negotiator?
I have. And I guess in my world, it's breaking down to its very simplistic parts what the issue is and what needs to be corrected to make the difference. So, yeah, when you're splitting differences, I'm just trying to get a good example. A while ago, a guy rings up saying, I want to go and buy an investment property. In those days, the Reserve Bank said that you had to have a 40% deposit to buy an investment property. And he only had a 20% deposit. So I said, well, you can do it, but it won't be a bank. It'll be a non-bank lender. The money comes out of Australia, which is how they get around the Reserve Bank restrictions. So the upside is you can do it. The downside is it's 1% more expensive than a bank, but you can do what you want to do. And he got really shitty. And it was disgraceful that a non-bank lender should charge him more than a bank and blah, 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 basically the founder. The next day, I think it was, very similar conversation with somebody else. My response was the same. You can buy an investment property with 20% deposit. It's a non-bank lender. This is how they do it. And it's going to cost you 1% more. And the guy said, cool, how do I apply? So same conversation, two very different outcomes. So the second guy went through, it settled. And about 6 months later, he rang me and said, I just want to say thank you again for what you did for me. I've just had an updated valuation done on the property. I did some minor cosmetics and I've made 80 grand in 5 or 6 months that I've owned the property. And it's all because of what you did. So I said, well, thanks for that. The way you can say thank you is to write a nice review. So we've got about 400 reviews up there from customers. And then I sat back and I worked out the difference between the bank interest rate and the non-bank interest rate, and it was $350 a month. So the first guy lucked out on making 80 grand profit for the sake of $350 a month. And that's what I try and get over to people, is interest rates, whilst they're important, they're not they're not the be all and end all. It's, does the overall package work? So splitting the difference in what you just said is exactly that. If you hone in on one thing, that can make or break a transaction. If you look at the overall transaction, yes, it's a little bit more expensive, but it does mean you can do what you want to do. And then you make a judgment call as to whether or not it works for you.
With non-bank lenders, what are they, like, is it, how do they work? Are they riskier because, you know, they're taking on less secure debt than the banks potentially, or they have less compliance ownership on them? Or what's the pros and cons of non-bank lenders, and do they have a good name or a bad name? Or what's the...
Well, if you asked me this 15 years ago, I would say every time I mentioned non-bank to a client or potential client, you would always be asked the same thing. So is it safe? Am I going to lose my house? You know, all that kind of stuff. As the years have gone by, the non-bank sector has matured. So what a lot of people don't know, and they've got no reason to know, unless it affects them, is non-bank lending in New Zealand is primarily funded by the banks. So the largest non-bank lender here is actually funded by Westpac. And we're talking over $1 billion worth of lending so far with that, just that one lender. And as time's gone by, the cost of funds from Westpac to that lender have actually gone down in relative terms because of the quality of the book. How has that loan performed? So in terms of legislation, you know, consumer protection, for example, there's no difference whether you borrow from a bank or a non-bank lender. You've got the same degree of protection. A non-bank lender can't suddenly say, actually, we don't like you anymore. We're going to call the loan in. And no more than a bank can. And a lot of people don't know that every mortgage contract ever issued in New Zealand, whether a bank, non-bank, whatever, well, particularly the banks, has a 30-day call-in notice. There's a clause in the contract that says we can call your loan in for no reason, giving you 30 days notice. That's standard. So there's no difference between bank, non-bank. Why do non-banks exist? It's all down to appetite. So a bank, if you've got maybe a bit of a credit glitch on your credit file, we've all been young once, we've all done silly things. A classic for first home buyers would be that you were flatting, and there might have been six of you in the house, but only one of you had the utility. The power bill was in your name. Come the end of the tenancy, everybody buggers off, and you get the final bill for $400. And you say, well, I didn't use all that. So you don't pay it. So the utility company ends up putting a collection or default notice on you, and you just forget about it. Until 3 years later, you go to the bank for a mortgage. Bank runs a credit search. Oh, look, there's a default on you. And therefore, the bank's appetite is we don't lend to people with defaults. So that's when people pick up the phone to us and say, shit, you know, I've been to the bank. I earn good money. I've got a reasonable deposit. They won't lend to me. No, they won't. But this lender will, until such time as you create a track record, build up a credit score, or in terms of defaults, it's more than 5 years old, it disappears anyway. And then we'll get you back to a mainstream bank. So you've turned a no into a yes. And that happens every day.
Because I've heard, you know, people come and go in the property sphere, and, you know, I like property in the sense of you're making money on money you don't have. I have no interest in pursuing it myself, but, and then also if you manage it right, it's a business, it can be successful and, you know, appreciates over time, tends to. Is there, like, on that agreement with the banks or non-bank lenders, like, are there common misconceptions around the potential risk for them? So it's like, you just said, okay, let's say I get a loan 1 year later, interest rates take off, and then I get sick, and then they call on the loan 30 days, and 30 days from now, they can just take it. Is that what happens? Like, and then the market's down?
It's a really complicated area. And I think, guess what we've been going through for the last couple of years really highlights that. So 2-3 years ago, 2-year fixed rates were under 3%. Now, that's unheard of for New Zealand. So the average rate in New Zealand is around between 6.5% and 7%. So what we're seeing now today in interest rates is actually average. What's unusual is the rate of change. So we've gone from under 3% to around 6% or 7% in such a short space of time. And that's hurt a lot of people and continues to hurt a lot of people. Anybody that believed 2 years ago or 3 years ago that the 2.5%, 3% interest rate was normal was kidding themselves. And all the property gurus, if you like, the economists and experienced advisors like me, were saying to people, this is unusual. This is historically very low. In terms of fixing a mortgage, you know, you can get 5-year money at 2.99%. You should take it. Unfortunately, the majority of people in New Zealand are so indoctrinated by the banks in their marketing that most people fix short, so 1 year or 2 years. So a lot of people fixed at 2.45, 2.99 for 2 years in the belief that interest rates would either remain low or continue to fall. And of course, that hasn't happened. So we're seeing a lot of stress in the market. The number of people heading towards mortgagee is the highest since the GFC. And we're seeing a lot of that. And the reality is at the peak of the GFC, according to the Reserve Bank, 1.2% of mortgages were in distress of the total volume. Today, it's 0.4% of the total book is in distress. So we're nowhere near the level that we saw in the GFC. Having said that, we are at the highest level of stress in the last 10 years. And that's caused by, obviously, the significant increase in interest rates in the last 18 months or so. Another thing which is perhaps misunderstood is negative equity. So that means you bought a house for $500,000 2 years ago. Because of the market, the house is now only worth $450,000. And you've got a $475,000 mortgage. So your debt exceeds the value of your home. So is that an issue? Well, it's an issue mentally because you owe more than you own. But from a lender's perspective, as long as you are repaying that mortgage, as long as the mortgage is paid, makes no difference. And then over time, that will redress itself. And historically, Auckland, particularly Auckland, doubles every 10 years, pretty much. And that data goes back to the 40s, and you can look at that online. And one of the interesting ones there is in the 1980s, where interest rates were in double figures, Auckland tripled in value between 1980 and 1990. So interest rates can have an interesting effect on how the market goes. So yes, there is stress out there. If people get into stress, they need to act on it. They need to do something about it. And that means contact your lender and have a meaningful discussion with your lender or an advisor and lay all your cards out on the table. You know, this is where I am. I need to do something about it. And I will say to people, doing nothing is not an option. You've got to do something.
Yeah, it's a common thing. Putting, you know, when there's ghosts in the room, you hide under the blankets. It doesn't mean the ghost goes away. Well, I don't believe in ghosts, but so what actually happens? So let's say you got a mortgage. What can the bank do if they've decided you're not the one for them? Like, and then once they've decided, what happens?
What's the process?
They sell your house.
So it's called a Property Law Act or PLA. So what happens is you're trucking along and something happens. You fall sick and you can't pay your mortgage and you bury your head in the sand and you just don't pay. And because the bank doesn't know why you're not paying, they have a whole team of people to try and get hold of you to say, hi, we know you haven't paid for the last 2 months. We're here to help, you know, what's going on, blah, blah. But you still put your head in the sand. When it goes to about 3 months, the bank tends to get a bit peed off and says, yeah, we've tried to contact you. You're not responding to emails, letters, phone calls, whatever. We now can go formal. So it's called a Property Law Act notice, which is a formal demand for the arrears. And you're normally given a month to either pay those arrears or come up with a payment plan that's realistic and gets things back onto an even keel. So let's say that doesn't happen. Whatever reason you decide, actually, just sorry, I'm going to keep my head in the sand and it's all going to go away. Because the bank doesn't know, the lender doesn't know what's going on, they have to assume sort of the worst because they've tried really hard to communicate. They then issue, if you like, the formal demand to call up the loan. So that's the mortgagee sale part. So you owe us $500,000. You haven't responded to any communication. You've got until the 15th of the month to repay the loan. And in the meantime, we'll be instructing a real estate agent to come and value the property, and they will be selling it at mortgagee auction. That's the worst of the worst of the worst. Because if it goes down that path, properties generally sell at mortgagee sale for a lot less than they do in a traditional sale and purchase agreement. And the reason for that, two potential reasons. One is, in a mortgagee sale, if you or I buy a property at a mortgagee auction and then we settle on that property in a month's time, there's no guarantee that what we saw today will be what we get in a month's time. So that's called vendor warranties. So in mortgagee, there are no vendor warranties. And I have seen a while ago now a new build property where on the day of settlement, the kitchen and bathrooms have been stripped by the tradies who put them in because they were not paid. So what the person who bought the property got was not what they saw. So for that reason, property tends to sell for less at mortgagee than it would in a traditional situation because you have got vendor warranties. Another one might be, if the owner of the property at mortgagee is in residence, generally speaking, they won't allow people to view the property. So you can view it from the outside. You can drive past. The agent might have taken drone pictures or whatever. You cannot see the inside. So therefore, people will not bid the full amount because they don't know what it looks like inside. You know, have you kicked all the jib in on the inside because you're going to be really miffed that you're about to lose your home. So for that reason, you know, that's not going to happen. And then the final one for that is, generally speaking, you cannot get insurance on a building on the fall of the hammer, between the fall of the hammer and when you settle, because the insurance company doesn't know what's going to happen to that property. So they can't be liable for something that they're at, you know, they're not in control of.
Gosh.
So our advice always with mortgagee is do something. And it may well be that you have to sell the house. It's very unfortunate. But if you sell it yourself in the normal way, you're going to get more money than if you allow the bank to sell it on your behalf. And then you just have to put aside all the, you know, a lot of people get very emotional and fully get that. You just have to park that. And make sure that you're doing the best you can.
Essentially, it makes sense. It's like, you know, if you lean into the resistance, it's going to help you. But like, if the banks know all of that and insurance companies feel that kind of way, and you go to the bank, say, hey, I can't pay it, we're going to sell it, and then you put in a graph to get like good value from it so that you don't have a big, massive debt, like, makes sense. It's just like hiding under blanket, eh?
It is. I mean, you know, we see quite a lot where people say, look, my mortgage is, you know, whatever it is, $2,000 a month. I can't pay that. I can pay $1,500. Okay. You know, that's a reasonable proposal. So the banks the banks bend over backwards to try and help. The last thing anybody wants is to go down the mortgagee road. It's just bad news. There isn't a good side to it from a lender, from the borrower. It's just horrible. So a bank will do, and they've got all sorts of tools they can use, whether it be they euphemistically call them payment holidays. They're actually payment deferments. So you can apply under hardship to suspend your mortgage for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 months. But bear in mind that whatever you're not paying is then tacked onto the mortgage at the end. So you end up paying interest on interest. As long as you understand that, that's fine. Most mortgages are on principal and interest. So every month you pay, part of it goes to pay the interest, part of it goes to clear the debt. You can apply to go interest only for a little while. So that will cut your payments. But your debt doesn't decrease. Well, that's minor in comparison to what might happen if you don't do that. So there are lots of tools available to help people, but people have actually got to man up, if that's the right word, and face it and deal with it.
What has been, I guess, your lessons in terms of facing and leaning into the resistance? Like, you would have had challenging moments and tend to falter. When someone else around me ends up in a horrible situation and I got to be there for them, I double down on the things that I know put me in a clear space. But when I fuck up and my life's fucked, I'll start eating the donuts. I'll be waking up late. I'll be getting complacent. So how do you face the demons, you know? How do you lean into the resistance?
I think, okay, so there's two answers to that. One is, I'm not perfect. I've been around a long time. I know how the lending works. I know people's nature. So I will say to somebody, right, this is the situation. This is where you are. My role is to take you where you were, where you are, and where you need to go. And in my advice would be to follow this path. And people either say okay or not. If they say not, then I say, okay, I've done the best I can for you. I hope it goes well. If you need me, you know where I am. And that's it. I've had a situation where people have got really knocky. They get very personal. And twice in the last few months, I've ended up saying to people, look, I'm probably not the right person to help you. I've given you my advice. I've told you what I think. It is based on many years experience. Not only are you choosing not to follow that path, you're actually being quite abusive. So I've got ladies that work for me, and I will not have anybody being abusive to my staff. You can be abusive to me, not my staff. And if they continue, I just say, I'm sorry, I'll cut the line here. Good luck. But please don't use my services. And unfortunately, I've had to do that twice. One very recently. And I'm okay with that. You know, I run a business. Like any business, I can, within reason, pick and choose who I do business with. We give a hell of a good service in what we do. And if somebody doesn't want to use it, that's fine. No problem at all. But please don't abuse me or my staff for trying to sort you out.
It's an art, because I often find people pleasing or being nice is more of an insecurity, and it's more of a selfish thing than actually doing anything for the person. Because you think about, if someone's behavior is not very good and you keep condoning it with being nice, what is the, you know, their life going to be like if no one confronts them about it and says, hey, no, this is not okay the way you're talking to me?
It becomes, if somebody doesn't say something, it becomes the norm, which is really bad. I never understand why people just need to be rude and abusive. There's no reason for it. It's normally covering up for something, maybe an insecurity, their own, if you like, their own failings, and they're not standing up to their own failings, not prepared to change. And hey, that's their problem, not mine.
Has there been something in terms of being challenging for you, like as you've developed through the career, like either as a leader telling someone a bad thing, like, hey, you didn't do this, or removing people from your life, or doing the things you don't want to do? What's been your biggest?
I think the gains, so the yeses are like 98%, and the noes are around 2%. So the noes hurt sometimes, but then that's so far outweighed by the yeses. You know, having thick skin, you draw a line under it. You can't change it. I always sit back and think, could I have done that differently? Could it have worked in a different way? And if the answer is no, you did your best. Well, you did your best. The fact that somebody's not accepting that, there's nothing I can do about that. So it doesn't, you know, I don't really sleep over it. And like today, you can't see this in camera shot. But today a box arrived from a very happy customer, and it's a bottle of vintage port. I'd rather concentrate on that than somebody who's, you know, just been abusive or won't listen. I'd rather concentrate on the person that says, yep, I hear you. This is what I need to do. What can I do to make it happen quicker or whatever it might be? And let's get it sorted. And everybody wins.
So the rejection initially, or the no from them, was quite disheartening when you first started, was it? And now you've gotten better at it. Is that what you just said?
That's a fair comment. Yes. Yeah. I think it's understanding or trying to understand the why. And sometimes you can't, you know? And sometimes when you do understand, you think, maybe I could have done that in a different way, or maybe this could have worked slightly differently. As the years go by, I can't say there's a situation I've never come across, because I don't know that until it happens. But I think I can say there are many circumstances I don't believe that I've not come across, and then can act accordingly. And if I don't know, there are other people in my industry that I can talk to and say, I've come across this. I've never come across this before. What would you do? And we have a chat. And and that's always anonymous. That's always, we strip out all the personal stuff. It's a scenario. Or I'll talk to an underwriter as a lender and say, I've never come across this before. 9 times out of 10, they have. And they either say we can deal with it or run away. You know, don't touch it with a barge pole. So that's just life, isn't it?
You hear rejections. What, out of curiosity, what would be your advice to that younger version of you that was getting those no's and it wasn't too nice? And maybe you're disheartened or whatever you might have felt.
Yeah, I think the answer would be take the personality out of it. Take the personal out of it. Generally speaking, people aren't attacking you as a person. You feel as if they are, but they're not. They are attacking the situation they're in, and they're using you as a foil to vent their frustration. And you just have to develop thick skin. And you know, it's not personal. People are frustrated, they're angry, they're upset. Maybe their expectation level was too high. Who knows? But whatever it is, they're taking that out on you as an advisor, and you just develop a skin. Simple as that. So not taking it personally is what I would say.
Yeah, I see an insult is an insecurity wrapped in blame.
Yes.
So thank you for coming on.
All good. No, great to be on. Thank you for that. And let's hope we have a decent summer here in Auckland. For those of you that don't live in Auckland, this year we didn't have a summer. And so far in our spring, we've had more rain than I can ever remember in this area. So let's just pray for a decent summer and a great Christmas and a break. And come back to the new year refreshed.
Yeah, and if there's anyone on a boat needing water, hopefully this is a service to you.
Star 500, put that in your cell phone, star 500. That will put you straight through the Coast Guard if you need help.
Well done. Thank you.
Awesome. Okay, take it easy.